From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
Our compatriot Noel is on adventures. They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know a pretty gory, grim episode for us today, man.
Yeah, let's go ahead and put this warning up here right now. We're going to be discussing some things that you may not want to hear. Especially if you dislike murder, sometimes dismemberment, sometimes torture, all kinds of things that make me squeamish. So if you feel that way, go ahead and turn back now.
Mm-hmm. If you're in the middle of eating something and you have a somewhat delicate stomach, perhaps it is time to put this on pause and finish your quesadilla or your pho, whatever.
Even if you find yourself, I don't know, in the backyard with a glass of wine, building a fountain. Just know that this one's a little messed up.
Serial killers, Matt.
Yeah.
Serial killers. We've explored their lives, their methods, and their attempts to evade justice and, you know, most disturbingly, the tragedies they leave behind in their wake. We've done this on multiple episodes, sometimes focusing on general tendencies, sometimes focusing on specific individuals. In an earlier episode, we traced the evolution of the term serial killer from its initial roots, and it's not a very old term, spoiler alert, to the modern day, along with the changing and at times controversial definitions involved. Usually when we talk about serial murderers on this show, we are talking about, let's see, we've done a three-part series on serial killers who were never apprehended.
Correct.
We've done some looks at cults that incorporated serial killing, some human sacrifice, and so on.
Yeah, a couple of individual ones like the original Night Stalker or the Golden State Killer?
Yes. That's a bit of good news, right?
Yeah.
Golden State Killer was finally apprehended. Was that 2018?
End of last year.
Mm-hmm. And when we look into these cases, we're typically exploring things in the modern day or in the recent past because for most of us, especially here in the West, when we think of serial killers, we generally tend to think of things that happened in the 20th century, maybe a little bit in the 19th century, but primarily the 1900s. It goes back to about then. And now we're going to explore something different. Today, we are looking into the past to search for the first recorded serial killers, if we could find those, the ancient murderers, the murderers of old, the ones who existed before the term serial killer was ever invented. And to do that, we first have to explain what we mean when we say serial killer, right?
That's right. Here are the facts. Oh, hey, it sounds so hokey when I say it. I'm sorry, everybody, but here are the facts. So a serial killer at the most basic level can be described or is categorized by the manner in which they kill someone. And along with the amount they kill someone, like the frequency in which they do this act. And according to the FBI, we've used them as our source before to discuss what a serial killer is. According to the FBI, a serial killer is someone who commits at least 3 murders over the span of a month. And then there's always some form of cooling down period, generally an emotional cooling down period in between those murders, those deaths. So this really sets them apart from, say, a spree killer, someone who kills a large amount of people over a short time span, or a soldier in battle who takes lives because it's part of their mission and job to do so. Mm-hmm. And in particular, it's that type of killer. So, okay, let's put it this way. A spree killer has the potential of killing more people generally in the span of, you know, a day or a week or something like that than perhaps a serial killer who kills even over the course of a year. Mm-hmm. Or at least there's a potential there. So it's not just sheer numbers. It's how they kill.
Right. And serial killers will often be differentiated from other individuals who murder multiple people in that they tend to have patterns of some sort, whether it is the perceived commonality of their victims, by which we mean something that the killer themselves sees in these victims that makes them all qualify as prey, or whether it's the method of homicide that they employ. So you can see how there are some important distinctions here. How many of these individuals are alive or uncaught today? Every time we look at this, we run into an unsurprising but unpleasant lack of evidence. The current estimates on serial killer numbers, you see, are woefully vague. And the people who have attempted to guesstimate the number of unapprehended serial killers or murderers at large, always walk away with a wide range of numbers. We're going to give you a couple just to set up some bookends here. Thomas Hargrove, this guy who founded the Murder Accountability Project. And according to Hargrove and his research, there are as many as 2,000 serial killers at large as of 2018. In the U.S., or at least in the Anglosphere.
Wow. That's a high number. Wow. And how did he get to that number? That's one of the big questions here. And really, he started by asking contacts that he had with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, asked them to calculate how many unsolved murders are linked to at least one other murder through DNA on the FBI's database. So there you go already, because they determined that about 1,400 murders, or roughly 2% of those, like of all the murders within that database, met the classification of being connected to at least one other. That's already pretty disturbing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you look at the fact that not all murder cases actually involve any kind of evidence of the DNA sort, at least, and not all cases are even reported to the FBI, so that 2% is a pretty low estimate. So then Hargrove went through and he said, okay, well, let's round it up to 2,000 just as a measure of what he believes could be closer, and that's because he continued looking.
Right. He said there are more than 220,000 unsolved murders just since 1980. So when we put that in perspective, he asked, how shocking is it that there are at least 2,000 unrecognized series of homicides? There's an important note here. So earlier, Matt, you had broken down the FBI definition of serial killer for us, and that's three or more murders,
yes,
right, with a cooling off period. The thing about Hargrove's study is that he only required a person to have killed two other people. So what happens when we stick to the definition of three murders per killer? That's when we run into Kenna Quinnett, a criminologist at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, and she has a much more conservative estimate. So her estimate is based on links between cases that were made by journalists or law enforcement, and there's a different metric in her study. The killer had to have murdered at least three victims, conforming to that FBI serial killer definition. By her definition, there are about 115 serial killers dating back to the 1970s in the U.S. whose crimes have never been solved. In the same time period as her estimate for unsolved serial murders, there were roughly 625 solved serial murder cases. And we don't mean that every single one of these people fits that sort of film and fiction definition. They're not all Hannibal Lecters. In fact, most serial killers do not have a very high IQ. But that's a lot of death, and 115 is still, it might still be missing some pieces, because this doesn't include cases where no one ever made a link between murders. If, for instance, a serial killer murdered a person in Arkansas and then drifted to an adjacent state to kill two more people, the crimes might never have been flagged by anyone as related, so they wouldn't appear in this count. And that's one of the biggest reasons experts believe that there could be any serial killers uncaught in our midst. People don't link up. You know, it's not like Charlie Day with a conspiracy wall. People are not linking up these various seemingly unrelated events, and it's tough to do so. You know, it's a lot of research and it's a lot of time.
I mean, yeah, where is Pepe? For real, though.
There is no Pepe Lopez. We had to inject some levity.
Yeah, just a tiny bit. Good God. Well, because it's a terrifying thought. Mm-hmm. Just the unknown serial killer that just could be lurking everywhere. And even if it's only 115.
That's still over 100.
Yeah.
Over 100 people.
There are only 50 states.
That's true. That's true. And I remember we had talked about this maybe off air one day, Matt, but we started talking about the distribution of serial killers,
yeah,
at least in the states. Are there more in Alaska or are there more in Florida and so on? And it's an interesting conversation because it quickly goes to speculation. We don't really know. We know that the interstate in Texas is very, very dangerous and the FBI has been keeping an eye on it. But if we count on these estimates, we can reasonably assume that there are somewhere between 150 to 2,000 killers who never saw justice for their crimes. Many of them may have been incarcerated for other unrelated crimes, grand theft auto, drug possession, something like that. And many may have died, right?
Yeah.
But as grisly as it is to point out, some remain at large and alive today. And it's tricky and not a little disheartening to realize how little we actually know about these numbers and these murders. A long time ago, actually, this is one of those conversations that you and I have been having for years, right, mm-hmm, with slight pauses in there. We've talked about it before, how much easier it seems to get away with murder and other crimes in the days before mass surveillance and forensic science.
Yes.
No one knew what fingerprints were. No one knew how to track DNA or even
if you got it, mm-hmm, it was a lot harder to match somebody up with a database.
Right. Yeah. There's no database. That's a good point. So this leads us to ask a disturbing question. Are serial killers a relatively recent phenomenon in the human story? How long have they been with us? Have serial murderers always been in our midst? The answer, sadly, is an emphatic yes.
Yeah, and it's about to get crazy after this quick word from our sponsor.
Here's where it gets crazy. Upon closer inspection, it appears that the act of serial murder has been with our species for as long as written history, and by all indications, predates written history. These killers ran the socioeconomic gamut. Among their number, we find people at the very top and the very bottom of social hierarchies. We find outcasts, royalty, criminals, and members of what functioned as the middle class. There are no common denominators for these murderers other than their actions. And here are some of the strangest examples of ancient serial killers we came across. By no means are these all of them.
Let's get started with someone named Zhu Shenatir. And this is from, originates from 5th century Yemen. So quite a time ago. This man was in the Himyarite kingdom. That's modern day Yemen. And this guy was known as, or at least he's come to be known as one of the first serial killers. The first recorded, at least. He was reportedly a very wealthy man. He lived in a place called Aden. And this guy, it's really disturbing. Remember that thing, that whole warning we gave you at the top? Just remember, it still stands. He would reportedly lure young men, young boys, into his home with the promise of things that they needed at the time in 5th century Yemen. or 5th century what is now Yemen, food, money, things, again, things that they required. And he would strip them naked. He would assault them. Generally, it included rape, at least from the things that we found. He would then kill them generally by throwing them naked out of an upper story window of his home. And he did this repeatedly. And then thankfully, one of the young men that he lured into his home was able to put a stop to him and stabbed him to death. There's a man at least that was named in one book that recorded it as Zarash, as the young man who killed him. Thankfully. But he's only the start, and he's really messed up, and it only gets worse.
Right, right. He is not the first. He is just one of the earliest that we know of.
Yeah, but again, because it's 5th century, so it was written down a little more easily than some of the even earlier ones that we'll find.
Very important point with Shushanatir. He was definitely doing this. We're going to run into some strange concerns we always need to have about historical documents, but this guy definitely was a child murderer and a somewhat prolific one until, of course, as you said, Matt, one of his victims managed to take his life. Let's move on to someone who is commonly called the world's first recorded serial killer or the world's first female serial killer. This is Locusta, the Poisoner. So she gets this title all the time. You'll hear it pretty often. I did an episode about her for another show, Ridiculous History, where I also called her one of the first recorded serial killers. But there's a question here. Because she wasn't so much a serial killer as a paid assassin. So members of the Roman elite were hiring her to poison the co-workers they didn't like or to get rid of their relatives if they wanted an inheritance, you know, and great Uncle Flavius has just taken too long to kick the bucket. She grew up in what we call France today, and she had an encyclopedic knowledge of herbal medicine and plant lore. The local elite saw her knowledge as a way to get rid of their enemies without a fuss, and she saw a market opportunity. So she wasn't necessarily motivated by some sort of, again, perceived commonality of the victims, right? She wasn't looking for young people or brunettes or so on. She was doing this as a job. And she became pretty famous. She was arrested a few times, but the people in power who used her services always kept her out of jail. She got rescued by her wealthy patrons numerous times, and eventually she was called to the city of Rome to assist the Empress Agrippina in getting rid of her husband. And she served Agrippina. She went on to serve the infamous Emperor Nero, who just loved her. And a lot of stuff about Nero is exaggerated, but he was not a nice character. When he died, she found herself robbed of all the protection she had enjoyed for decades. She had even set up a poison school at this point. She was immediately sentenced to death for her role in the murders of dozens and dozens of upper crust members of Roman society. And again, like the case with Shushanatir, we know that she was real and we know she actually did this.
Yeah, exactly. As soon as I think Galba was the person who took over after Nero fell. But yeah, he definitely said, hey, guess what? You get to die now. It's really messed up. But at least somebody put an end to the assassinations. Now let's move on to one of the first forms of serial killers that we ever covered on this show back in a video we made about werewolves and the history of lycanthropy. Fascinating stuff. So if we go to the Middle Ages in Europe, there were a lot of killers, deranged people who would go around doing just terrible things, everything from murder to cannibalism, just the worst of the worst. There were human men that would go out and do this that were considered to be werewolves, or at least thought to be werewolves. And there are some pretty intense claims made about these men, even claims by the men themselves who believed, perhaps truly believed, that they would transform in some way to a wolf, or at least the spirit of a wolf.
Mm-hmm. In the 16th century, there was a French peasant named Pierre Bourgeot who was apparently under the control, the thrall of several figures clad in black. This is per his testimony, including one man named Michael Verdun. So according to Bourgeot's story, Verdun gave him an ointment that would transform him from a man into a wolf. And we talk about this a little bit in the past in various episodes. The way that werewolves are generally thought to transform nowadays is you get bit by a werewolf, but you survive.
Yes.
That's the way in, right? And then you follow the path of the wolf. However, back then, you could become a wolf through any number of weird satanic rituals, drinking water from a wolf's print in the light of the full moon, wearing a belt made out of a wolf pelt, or just rubbing yourself down with some ointment.
Yeah. Or you know, taking a potion, as you said before. There are a lot of ways that people could be, you know, from a very rational standpoint, a lot of ways that people could be convinced that mm-hmm. they can become a werewolf or have become a werewolf.
And there's some pretty fascinating arguments that are by no means waterproof, but there are some pretty fascinating arguments that some of these ointments were, in fact, hallucinogens. And so these people really did, at least from their perspective, transform, even if not physically. There was a third guy who was named in this fiasco with weird, really weird first name, Philibert.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like a killer. Philibert Montaut. So Bourgeot, Montaut, and Verdun became known as the Werewolves of Polygony, and they were collectively responsible for the murders of several children. They confessed to these murders.
They did, but why did they confess, Ben?
Oh, because they were getting tortured left and right, day in, day out, like nobody's business.
And full-on tortured, bad torture, beyond the things that you see in any mob movie you've ever seen. It's really, truly medieval stuff.
Such to the point that they could have easily died during the torture. So they catch Verdun, and allegedly they catch him covered in blood. And they begin torturing him. Confess to your crimes. What infernal powers have allowed you to transform into an otherworldly agent of Satan? And who was with you? Tell us essentially what your coven is.
Yeah.
And identify the members therein. So under torture, he confesses to whatever they say he did. And then he says, also, these two guys, Bourgeot and Montaut, are in on this with me. And then they get apprehended. Bourgeot gets tortured. And he says, these two guys forced me to renounce God and turn into a werewolf. I had to do it to survive. And, you know, they're breaking more of his limbs and they're saying, did you kill hundreds of children? He's saying something like, yes, please, God, stop. Don't kill me.
And just quickly as a sidebar, let's talk about the torture that was used against these guys, because it's something that I've seen pictures of before and I looked at it again, and you may have heard of it, called something that's a torture wheel of sorts. And in a lot of these pictures, these woodcuts that still remain today, copies of them, you can see what's being employed, and it is so brutal. I'm going to describe it, trigger warning here, where you are laid down and there are, I guess, wedges put beneath the places in where your joints are, and your major arm and leg bones are broken. And then where those bones are broken, you are wrapped around this wheel, like a wooden, it looks like a large wooden wagon wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And then you are hung from on this wheel, on a stake of some sort, and basically turned upside down, while you're still alive. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine. You can find pictures of it. The thing is, if you can imagine, which is very difficult to do, going through something like that and the pain and terror involved, then it really does make you realize that the confessions made when undergoing that are to be taken with a grain of salt.
Absolutely. And we probably will never know for sure to what degree these three men were guilty. However, they were not the only quote-unquote werewolves of the time. There was a serial killer who was also a cannibal named Peter Stump, sometimes spelled Stumpf or Stube, and he was called the Werewolf of Bedburg. He was a one-armed farmer, lived in 15th century Germany. Over the course of 25 years, he's thought to have murdered 14 children, two pregnant women. And he might not have ever been caught, but like many serial killers, he seemed to have a degrading mental state.
Yeah.
Which is how, you know, things like Dennis Radar, right, the BTK killer, would have gotten away had his mental state not continued to decay such that he felt like he had to be recognized for his terrible, terrible crimes. This guy, Stump or Stumpf or Stube, when he was caught, he said, "Look, yeah, I drank that cow's blood. You know what else? I also have eaten fetuses. And I had a son. I ate his brain. I don't care. I'm a monster." And the thing was, in his non-killer life, he was a wealthy farmer. And he was a widower. He had two children, the son of an unknown age, and a daughter called Beale or Sybil, who was, as far as you know, at least older than 15. He was subjected to torture. He was stretched on a rack, and that's when he claimed he had been practicing black magic since he was 12 years old. He said the devil had allowed him to change into a wolf. And for 25 years, he said, he had been an insatiable bloodsucker. Animals, men, women, children. He confessed when he was presented with the possibility of more torture. And he was also accused of having an incestuous relationship with his daughter. She was sentenced to die with him. And he said that he had had intercourse with a succubus, again, confessing under torture. This did not save him. These confessions instead led to his execution on October 31st, 1589. He, his mistress, and his daughter were murdered. And he was murdered in a particularly gruesome way. He was put on the wheel that you mentioned earlier, Matt, and they tore flesh from his body in 10 places with red-hot pincers. Then his arms and legs, then his limbs were broken with an axe head to prevent him from returning from the grave. And he was beheaded. They burned his body. His daughter and his mistress were flayed and strangled and then also burned along with him. And the authorities placed his severed head on top of a pole with a torture wheel and a figure of a wolf on it. So they were convinced that he did something. While none of these men were, of course, proven to be capable of physically changing shape, contemporary accounts paint a picture of one or two possibilities. One, they could have been mentally ill and homicidal.
Yeah.
Two, they could have been mentally ill and confessing to non-existent or exaggerated crimes. C, and this is a distinct possibility, they could have been completely innocent and falsely confessing to avoid further torture. But there's an entire genre in Europe around this time of people being accused of lycanthropy. And this is just the beginning of the story. We'll come back with more tales of ancient serial killers after a word from our sponsor. We've been in Europe for some time. Let's travel to South America, to the story of Rios y Lespuguer.
Yes, this is a woman who is also known as La Quintrala, and this had to do with her, the color of her hair. She had very striking red hair. And she lived in Chile. She was an aristocrat and a landowner. She allegedly carried out about 40 murders, around 40 murders, while she was basically a tyrant of sorts over a lot of just a lot of people who were working on her estate. They're indigenous workers who then she was in charge of. And she was just brutal to them, apparently. Now, she was a member of, what would be considered a privileged set of people in colonial Santiago. And she was said to just have delighted. It was her – she very much enjoyed doing depraved things, things that were sacrilegious in nature, I guess, to the church, things that were sexual and, you know, having to do with consumption, like overindulging, copious consumption.
Hedonistic, right?
Exactly. It's hedonism. That's exactly what it is. And there's another person, Elizabeth Bathory, from history that we've kind of heard about a couple of times, that this person, La Quintrala, has similarities with. She had a violent temper. Again, she's a noble woman. She's got a fondness for torture and specifically torturing people who are underneath her, her subordinates. She seemed to delight in it, like we said. Now, besides, her indentured servants and her slaves, she also murdered lovers, which is something we may see here in the future here. She even murdered a priest and even committed patricide and killed her father. Now, you know, in this case, a lot of the people we've spoken about haven't been wealthy, but this is one of the first cases we see that the wealth is actually being used to avoid justice. It's kind of like the person from Rome we were speaking about, Friends in High Places.
Locusta,
where she was able to use her influence to avoid justice for quite a while, several years, in fact. And she even would donate to the church. To the Catholic Church in order to kind of grease the hand in a way to be a little bit safer, even though it's kind of a known thing maybe.
Yeah, she Epsteined it essentially.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because she was paying off judges and lawyers. She had many relatives in political positions. She did go on trial, but despite being pegged for 40 separate murders – the trial was stalled as a result of her influence. She was released, and then this is around the 1600s. From 1637 on, she was released, and she lived out the remainder of her life. She eventually passed away in 1665 of old age, not in jail. And 30 years later, the judiciary system caught up and they said, let's investigate these things. But she was dead. So whatever she did, whatever kind of justice she would face, it would not be earthly justice. And years after her death, her home was abandoned because people thought that her ghost still walked the premises.
Ooh.
And let's stick with female serial killers here. There's another one, Giulia Tofana. As we know, there's a stereotype that tells us female serial killers generally seem to prefer poison as their primary murder instrument. This is a stereotype. Stereotypes are everywhere. There may be a tendency, but that's certainly not everybody. However, Giulia Tofana is a poster child for the compulsive poisoning crew.
And again, like similar to our earlier example.
Mm-hmm. And here's our question. We have confirmed kills on her side, but is she a serial killer or is she someone in a gruesome profession? She was helping wives who wanted to kill their husbands, along with her daughter who worked with her and a couple of assistants. And they were mass producing poison. It was believed to be related to arsenic. So is she a businesswoman? Is she a killer? Is she both?
And she even had a poison named after her, right?
That's true. Yeah. What was it?
It's the specific, I guess, version of arsenic, right? the Acqua Tofana.
Mm-hmm. Acqua Tofana. So don't take it if you read that in an ingredient list or anything. Don't bother with that. Put those cheese nips away.
Yeah. It's not a fancy bottled water, Acqua Tofana. That's what it sounds like to me.
And we have time for one more. Let's see. Let's go with Liu Pingli. Liu Pingli was a Han prince, like some of our other early serial killers. He was from wealth. He was born in the 2nd century BC. He is one of the earliest serial killers that we have on record. So there are a couple different competing ones here. He's the third son of Liu Hui, who is Prince Xiao of Liang, and the grandson of the Emperor Wen and the nephew of the Emperor Jing. So he is very, very well connected. According to a book called Records of the Grand Historian, this guy was a monster. He was arrogant and cruel, and his idea of a fun time would be to round up some of his friends or his followers and go on marauding expeditions with slaves from the court or with young men who were on the wrong side of the law, and they would literally ride out around town in the countryside, and they would murder people for fun and steal their stuff just because he thought it was a lark.
Wow, it's like the definition of marauder. Is that a correct term?
Yeah.
Gosh.
This is not like the werewolves of polygamy, right? We know exactly what he did. He killed, and his crew killed over 100 people, and they became infamous. These murders were known across the kingdom, and people were afraid to go out at night. Eventually, things get to a boiling point, and someone, a son of someone he had killed, accuses him and tells the emperor, you know, look, your son is a monster. He's running around killing people for sport. And as soon as that person said it, other people spoke out, and officials in the court said, you have to kill your nephew. More than 100 people have died. How many more have to die? And the emperor said, I can't bring myself to kill my nephew no matter what kind of person he is, but I will do the next best thing. He stripped Liu Pingli of all of his royal titles, made him just a regular schmo, and banished him to County Shangyang. What happened after that? We don't know, because again, it's very difficult for us to trace the lives of commonplace people at this day and time, you know?
Yeah. When he got stripped of that title, it kind of banished even what he did to the unknown.
But this is pretty surprising stuff when you see, just from a few examples, you see how prevalent serial murdering is, or at least the accusations thereof. That's where we have to talk about the problems with historical accounts, right?
Yep.
The same sources that would appear to be our primary means of learning a story may often be the very same sources that prevent us from learning the truth. Because you think propaganda is bad now?
Oh, buddy.
Right?
When you're the one who survives the end of a sword and the other person does not, you can write whatever you want.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, history is written by the winners, and often just seeing something in print was enough to damn someone in the public eye. There's a fantastic book called Devil in the Shape of a Woman that looks at this practice in the Salem witch trials.
Yeah.
And what we find is that more so in Europe, but also a little bit in Salem, there are questions of motive. Did the accusers always believe someone was in league with the devil, or were they pushing the case because according to law in some communities, the inquisitors or the accusers got a piece of the person's estate when they were found to be a witch?
It's definitely possible, right?
Right.
And you got to think about literacy rates as well in general for certain regions where things are happening historically, and also the people who can read the stuff that is being written. There are a lot of times the people who can make the laws or enact justice, right, or something to that effect. And when there's a written document that says it's an accusatory document, it's going to stand out with the people who are looking to root out heresy, to root out things that would go against the church and or the state sometimes, the nation, but usually the church.
And in several of the cases above, despite these salient historical questions, we have found corroborating sources that appear to confirm some basic and disturbing truths. And just with this small collection of examples, we have illustrated that the concept of serial murderers predates the term serial killer. The same psychoses are present, if not prevalent, and we will never know how many serial murderers existed. We don't have a particularly sharp understanding of how many exist today. However, we can surmise that this practice and these people have been with humanity since before the dawn of modern history, a dark shadow following behind our species from the day the first Homo sapiens emerged.
Yeah. And, oh my God. And let's bring something else up here really fast. We've been talking about serial murders and serial killers and how many may exist right now. Well, there's a person that we talked to through the Zodiac Killer show named Peter Vronsky, and he brings up a very fascinating idea here. He believes that when there's economic downturn, especially on a wide scale in any region or globally even or just in a town, the probability of creating a future serial killer who is going through this, the economic downturn, all the realities that you face when that's happening, he believes that you increase the probability of creating serial killers. And in his opinion, he wrote a book called Sons of Cain. And in it, he describes how because of the financial crisis from 2007-2008, we are actually creating a new generation of serial killers. Or we have generated essentially a new season of serial killers that will emerge 10, 20 years from now. And he believes that that economic downturn at least in some way helped to create those serial killers. Fascinating stuff.
Fascinating. Fascinating. I'd love to check out this book. I'd love to learn more about his work. Let us know if you've read this book and let us know what your take is. Do you think that's correlation? Do you think it's causation? Which killers do you think should be remembered or learned from in the modern day? What are other ancient serial killers that you think your fellow listeners should hear about? Who, if anyone, do you believe was falsely accused due to the politics or the power games of the time? Let us know. You can drop us a line at our Facebook page. Here's Where It Gets Crazy. You can write to us on Twitter or Instagram. And if you, like an increasing number of people, despise social media, you can call us directly.
Our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. You can leave a message. You got about 3 minutes. If you're like Wayne out there, maybe you're working a security job and you just want to give us a call because you're feeling a little bit lonely and it's very dark and kind of creepy in the place where you're employed. Maybe you just want to tell us a story about a, I don't know, an unidentified flying object that you've experienced in your past, like one of our other listeners. Hey, just leave us messages. Anybody else? There's so many cool people who have left messages. I'm talking to you out there. You know who you are. Become one of them and leave us a message. We can't wait to hear it.
And if you, like me, will go to cartoonish lengths to avoid ever having to be on a phone under any circumstances...
He did record the outgoing message, at least.
I'm right there with you. But the good news is you don't have to just hop on the horn. If you have something you want to share with us and none of those other ways are quite bagging your badgers, you can always email us directly. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.